Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We made this.
Hello everyone and welcome to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. My name is Kurt North and welcome to our continuing coverage of Season 7 of The X-Files. And joining me today are two guests. One guest who's been on the podcast before but hasn't been on the main show. And that would be Baz Greenland. Baz, how you doing, mate?
Yeah, I'm good. Looking forward to chat about this, yes.
Yeah, last time I spoke to you we were talking a bit about Doctor Who.
Yeah, so I don't know when this episode is going to go out, but the end of October is the TARDIS crew episode where we're talking about the Harrison trilogy, which was a lot of fun.
Excellent. I'm on everything at the moment. Great. Back after his season 6 Trevor escapades is none other than Luke Winch. Hi, Luke. How you doing?
I think I might have had a few too many cigarettes this week. I'm all right, thank you.
You came on the Zoom call to say that you were doing too much wine, and now you're doing too much drinking, too much smoking as well. So fantastic. we get down to business. Again, I've got another 5 questions of X, and that's for you, Baz. So let's jump straight into your 5 questions of X.
Okay.
First up, when did you discover the X-Files?
So pretty much back at the beginning, it used to be on BBC Two in the UK. So I got into it very, very early season 2, just before Sky's abduction. So I didn't really know much about the X-Files season 1, but then it came on BBC Two, and I think it was about 2 or 3 episodes in. So pretty much from the start. And then I watched all of it. Kind of fed off towards the end with going to uni and find a bit of a life after sitting from college and then going out and that before I went to uni as well. But I kind of came back at the end and watched the finale. But I always get the double feature length movie VHS tapes as well. I used to collect all of them, so I just love them. So I'd catch up on mythology as I went with those VHS purchases too.
Okay, so he even bought Providence and Provenance.
I didn't know. I mean, I didn't know. No, I did up to about season 7. So, I don't think I've watched. Okay. I think like season 8, I didn't watch much later. So,
So, it would be around about this time then, wasn't it? Because this was this episode we're going to look at later shortly is April 16th, 2000, this episode aired, which is Brand X.
So,
around about this time. I've had the same kind of discussion either on the podcast or offline. That this is the moment where, I'm hitting 19, 20 year old. It's things are starting to get in the way a little bit that I'm not as, I would watch it week to week. Don't get me wrong. I watched it right through week to week, right through to the end of season 9. But this was the moment when I might not have had the time to rewatch before the next week, if you see what I mean. I used to watch them 2 or 3 times in a row, but around this time it wasn't to be. Okay, then. So what would you think to your favorite season?
It's a tough one. I think it is season 2 for me, though. Maybe it's because of the way I got into the X-Files. Even when I rewatched the X-Files, season 2 mythology is so exciting. When you got the abduction and the colony and obviously Anasaz at the end as well. And I think there are probably better seasons. Maybe 3 and 4 are probably sound overall. There's less clunkers. Maybe season 2 is a couple of clunkers. But now season 2 is just firing all cinders and just getting bigger and bigger. So for me, it's season 2.
Okay, then. Episode. Favourite episode. What would be your favourite episode?
I love a good experimental episode. So Triangle is my absolute favourite. I adore Triangle. I think it's just everything about it. The experimentation, the having fun with the alternate casting, that one tracking shot of Scully in the office, and then all of it comes together at the end. It's just, it's so much fun. I love the fun X-Files, and yeah, that for me is top tier for me.
Okay, did you get to hear all our specials? We did a lot on Triangle last year.
Yeah, I caught some of it, and I need to go back and listen to it again. But yeah, no, it's such a good episode. I mean, you can't not but enjoy that one, can you?
No, exactly. And I have my own things on Triangle, which I know Luke's laughing at me, but yeah, I have my own feelings on what actually happened there. Which
Season 6 of the X-Cast was 40% Triangle, 60% everything else.
Pretty much, fair enough, yeah. Okay, favourite character. It can be Mulder, it could be Scully, it could...
I think it is Scully. I think Scully is such a great... Julianne Anderson's so superb. She's superb in everything she's in.
Yeah.
But I think it's got to be Scully, but... I mean, if you take Scully, I mean, Mulder's also good. David Duchovny's very good, particularly with the emotional stuff. But I mean, also, I probably... Doggett's close behind. I love Doggett. I love Season 8 as well. It's one of my favourites, and... Doggett is great too, but I think you can't really beat Scully for me.
Excellent. And finally, what would be your favourite moment?
That's a tough one. I think really it's probably the Season 2 cliffhanger and Anasazi, just the way it all came together in those final few minutes, and it's so big. I remember watching The Unopened File over and over again on VHS when that three-parter was released, and yeah, just... Everything about that three-parter I absolutely adore. And yeah, the cliffhanger of Season 2 is just superb. I don't think it ever got as good as that, I think.
Yeah, the Unopened File, I remember it vividly with the sticker on saying, you know, previous unreleased Season 3 episode and all that kind of thing. It's it's one of those things. I was actually talking on a different podcast, on a Red Dwarf podcast, about a VHS release that they had and just how many memories that brings back for me. And it's just part of my childhood. And the Unopened File was one of those moments, and that is it. You are inducted into the Hall of Fame. That must be quite a length, because you know I remember listening to you on the podcast a significant time ago, I think.
Well, I was involved in the X-Cast a little bit. I mean, I did a lot of the pod watches. I did quite a few of those in the lead up to with the new series when it came back, and I did about two per season. So it's not technically my. I'm not brand new to the X-Cast, but in terms of just an episode, I am, certainly. So, yeah, I did a lot of the pod watches, and I also did come along with Sarah a few years ago to discuss the novel Whirlwind, which is an interesting X-File novel, too, shall we say. But, yeah, we had a lot of fun discussing that as well.
Excellent. Okay, then let's dive straight into what we are here on the business side of things. So we are here to talk about Brand X, Season 7, Episode 18. It was the 19th produced, and it was directed by Kim Madders and written by Stephen Maeder. And this is an episode all about those Morley cigarettes. Luke, what are your first impressions? What would you say about this episode in general, and what would you rate it out of 10?
For me, this episode teeters on the line between mildly interesting and boring. It's not one of my favourite episodes. There are some good things you can take from it. There's some nice, particularly production design elements that I really enjoyed. The episode, I think, for me, feels quite weary, and I think this has been said a lot during the Season 7 X-Cast, that a lot of people have talked about the... everyone looking tired or the season feeling tired, the stories being a bit weary. And I think it kind of creeps into this in some ways. But it also kind of retroactively also feels like an early X-Files in the way that you've got Mulder coming up with these wild theories and Scully and Skinner this time because he's in this episode quite momently, both of them kind of putting him down until it gets to the point where they can't actually look at any other theory but this one because it's the most practical one going forward. So there's that kind of old style formula that the early seasons of X-Files had. So there's a kind of fight between those two things. Particularly with Duchovny and Anderson as well, I think they were both working on their project episodes as well at this time. So you've got All Things and Hollywood AD, which means that the writers had to find ways to not have them in so much. I think I roughly counted how many minutes they're in for this episode, and it's between 15 and 16 of the 42 minutes each. Yeah.
Okay.
So they're not in it that much because, you know, they're having to work on their respective episodes. Like Trevor, in a way, you know, because they had to find ways to get Duchovny and Anderson off there. So you bring in two good character actors, and they've done this again with Tobin Bell and the guy called Dennis Boutsikaris, who plays Voss. So you got two guys who can hold...
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business?
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Another 20, 25 minutes of screen time, and they do it quite well, actually. So, and also, Kurt, to jump on what you've talked about as well, because you've talked a lot about the theme of time and time slowing down.
Yeah.
And I think you can kind of extend on that to this, because I think there's a certain... finality and running out of time, because of course smoking shortens your lifespan, and there's a certain fatality that Weaver has. You know, I think he knows that he's going to die, so he has this kind of almost invincible attitude that he can just get away with anything he wants. So yeah, that's my, I mean, I would probably give it about a 5 out of 10 if I was gonna give it, because I think it teeters on, as I said, mildly interesting and a little bit boring.
Excellent. Okay, so Barry, what do you think?
I don't know, maybe a little bit more, maybe a 6 out of 10. It's one of the ones that I didn't really remember at all. I mean, season 7, I mean, it's been said time and time again, season 7 is tired, it's them running out of steam, and you do get a sense of that in this episode. There's no one seems particularly enthused about being in the episode, particularly Duchovny and Anderson. And but it's held together by like Tobin Bell as the Ashman, or as he's known in the episode. And there's some good stuff in there. You write about that kind of old school horror element. You know, the bug attacks are really, really nasty, and they're very much that kind of early X-Files, you know, the sort of thing that the show would go back to in season 8, when they go back to those kind of darker roots. And it's almost like a attempt to go back there, because, you know, season 6 and 7, you know, we said they're very sunny, they're very bright, they don't feel quite as atmospheric as those early seasons. And this one surprised me that it had a little bit of atmosphere there, which helped, but there's not much really to hang it on. I think it's a decent episode. It's better than I remembered, but it's not necessarily one of the best of the season, certainly.
So, I mean, I would echo a lot of what you've both said. I actually enjoyed rewatching this one. I've seen it twice in the last few weeks. It's interesting that Carl's been trying to persuade me about Thief, and I could not get with that episode. I just couldn't get with it. But this one, I actually enjoyed more than that. And I think with what you're saying, the both of you are saying about the fact it's kind of going back to the old school, it's almost like approaching the season 8 kind of aesthetic that I like the mood of the piece. I think the final third kind of fails it. But there's still aspects in the final third that I really do like, and we'll talk about that as we get into the episode. I would probably give this, actually, surprisingly enough, a bit more than both of you, maybe a 6.5, maybe approaching a 7. because I just found that this is a good watch. I enjoyed it. And as I say, there is moments, there's things that I'm not particularly that fond of, but as an episode of TV, and if it had been earlier in the season, they were finding the feet, I might have rated it a bit higher, but because we are in season 7, then it does falter in that way. So it's certainly an interesting episode, an interesting time, you know, bear in mind this is coming in late in the season. And I think, Baz, you've hit the nail on the head with the, the thing with moving into season 8. So it's an interesting one. You mentioned about Tobin Bell and Dennis Busiekaris, or whatever he's called. Not normally butcher people's names, so I apologise if Dr. Voss is listening, who also was in ER, which took me ages to work out where I knew him from. And it was like, I've seen him in something else, and it's bugging me, and I didn't want to go on IMDb to check. But eventually I had to.
Yeah.
He also plays Rich Schweikart in Better Call Saul as well.
Ah, right, okay. Well, yeah, I'll know from that as well. But Richard Cox is the first person that I instantly recognised. Do you know who he's, what else he's been in?
No.
No, because I'm sick of saying, in this series, in this season, I'm sick of saying the name. But he was in Millennium. He was... Alistair Pepper, who's a lawyer who is in a really powerful episode in Lamentation and Powers, Thrones, Principalities and Dominions, or whatever which way around it is. And he tries to seduce Frank into working for him. So he's part of the Legion arc. So I instantly recognised him, and I think he's a great actor. Some of the CGI as well, I'm not that fond of, you know, with the Richard Cox. It looks okay. It's not the best I've seen, but it does a job, but it could have been a bit better. And finally, just as a general note, before we go into the deep dive of the X-Files, of this X-Files episode, is do either of you watch or have seen Blacklist? The Blacklist.
Yes, I've seen quite a lot of that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's a season 6 episode which has it's brought in early season 6, and it's a weaponized insect attack, and it does basically exactly what happens in this episode, and it comes back at the end of the season as a delivery system, and the episode is called General Shiro. All I'll say is that there is a bit of a return to this. Any ideas what General Shiro is based on?
No.
A little task for you. General Shiro is on a real-life person, General Shiro. He was in a unit called 731.
Ah.
Oh.
Very cool.
who did a lot of experiments on insects, apparently, as a weapons thing. So just a full circle there. I realized that today. I went, what is that episode? I saw Blacklist, and I saw the name. I went, Shiro's armor, and I didn't make that connection right then. I just thought, oh, that's quite interesting. That's good. And then I looked more into the actual name, that it was the guy from Unit 731. So that's interesting. So let's dive straight into in more depth this episode, which is Brand X. First up, we've got Skinner and we've got the director of the FBI. So this in itself is quite big. Now, as our resident Michael Mann expert, Luke.
Hello.
Feel free to discuss this, because the general setting is a cigarette, you know, a tobacco company and everything that goes along with that. And a lot of people make the connection because it was around the time of a film. Which was aired around the same time as this. I think it was going for Oscars, I think, at the time, called The Insider. So can you give us any further information on that?
Yeah, so the writer of this episode, Stephen Maeda, and there was another gentleman as well who co-wrote this episode.
Greg Walker.
That's it. So these they wanted to basically riff off of The Insider. So The Insider came out November 1999. and general release in the cinemas. This episode came out, as you mentioned earlier, April 2000. So there's a, it's really close, really, really close, these two things. And actually, the Jeffrey Wigand, who is the whistleblower in The Insider, because The Insider is based on real events, and Jeffrey Wigand was a real whistleblower who worked for a tobacco company, and he went on 60 Minutes, the American chat show, to talk about why he wanted to whistleblow and what he did for this tobacco company. So he was on 60 Minutes in 1996. So between that and this X-Files episode, we got 4 years, which is a really, really small amount of time for a film to be made about it, and then almost instantly an episode which is riffing off of that idea. So I found that really interesting. Yeah, so Jeffrey Wigand's basically whistleblowing because in The Insider, which if you haven't seen is definitely worth a watch, I think it's Michael Mann's, one of Michael Mann's strongest film along with Heat, Jeffrey Wigand basically was not happy with the company using other chemicals to make the cigarettes more addictive. So they were putting in more ammonia and another chemical called cumin. So, and you know, he was very unhappy about this. So he whistleblows. So this beginning scene, with Scobie, I think it is, James Scobie.
Yeah.
So he is also seems like a researcher, scientist guy. So very similar to who Jeffrey Wigand was. And it doesn't surprise me that, because of this high-profile case, he is a prime witness, that they get the FBI involved, and you know the director is very much involved with this, and he's put Skinner on the case. So it's mirroring a lot of real life events and what would probably happen in such a high-profile case against a huge global tobacco industry. So I found that very interesting, actually.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Buzz, what do you think to the actual opening then with that in mind? It actually plays up to that quite well, the way that that it's using Skinner, for example. Mm. It's also a good way of rewriting, you know, the fact that, as Luke alluded to, there's not much Mulder and Scully in this. You've got the third wheel in this one, so I don't know if he's been in more than 15 minutes, Skinner, but he might well be. So it's a good way to bring him in as well. But the general kind of feel and theme and the way that this is played, what do you make to this opening?
I mean, I think it's a really good old school X-Files pre-title sequence. It's a good, effective pre-title sequence. You know, I mean, it's good to have Skinner in there. And obviously, Skinner's a good character to have in if you are going to have much more on Scully, because obviously, you know, he's a great character, you know, but recurring character that's certainly at this point now. And it's great to have kind of see Skinner in action there with the FBI. And there's a real sense of kind of tension and drama with this grand jury witness as well. So that's really interesting. But I think for me, it's that kind of the horror element. You know, as soon as Jim coughs, you know he's done for. And I think the discovery of his half-eaten face is nasty. And it's like proper good classic X-Files there. It's sort of stuff you would have seen time and time again in like season 2 and 3. And I really liked it. I thought the opening is a really strong opening, very effective opening.
Yeah, no, I mean, what do you make to the opening, Luke? Obviously, with what you said, where do you think it's effective?
Yeah, I mean, I like that first shot where you get the smoke and it just turns out to be the chimney. The production designer for this episode, Corey Kaplan, apparently he worked quite close with Kim Manners because they wanted to really get this dirty, greasy feeling to the episode. So they used a lot of browns and yellows. So I like that kind of pan out shot of the house. And the lights inside the house through the windows are very yellowy, browny colour, even though none of them smoke in that household, you've got this sense of, you know, this hazy, murky, greasy feel to the episode. And that, I mean, that's heightened later on when Tobin comes in and the way they've dressed him and made him look as well. But from the outset, you get this kind of visual aid that this episode is about tobacco. It's about cigarettes. And I thought it was really effective. And the practical effects, I think, were fantastic. The kind of eaten away mouth is pretty rank. I think the second death has better practical effects. When Skinner turns the body over, there's a little bit of plasticness to the skull, but I think the second death is much more effective and looks pretty icky.
Yeah, it's a bit up and down, isn't it? Because as I said at the beginning, there the end with Brimble, is it Brimble? Brimley, sorry. His is a little bit CGI'd. So it's a bit up and down. But I can forgive that in this episode. I think it's dark enough to do that. And I think you're right. The second death is probably the best part of it. And I also like the adding of the mystery as well in the scene coming out of the credits where he doesn't smoke and, you know, Mulder makes a quip about the GM Ford thing. And Mulder's obviously the one that witnesses the water on the table and all that, which is typical Mulder kind of, investigative work. He's always ready to dip his hand in, isn't he? Literally on many of occasion. So I think that all kind of works well. I mean, the following scene after that is at the headquarters, and this is where we get the corporate stuff. And it plays on that quite heavily. Baz, what do you make to that? The way that the lawyer, he's lawyered up, and we can talk in more general terms with Dr. Voss as well. That they just the interplay between him hiding behind the lawyers and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's certainly got a certain scale to it as well, which is really good. And I really like these Morleys, obviously, which is a big part of the X-Files. But obviously, Morleys aren't just part of the X-Files. Morleys appear in kind of many TV shows. So it's great to kind of play into that and sense a scale around Morley. I mean, I always assumed until a few years ago that Morleys were a real cigarette because they appear in so many TV shows, prominently in the X-Files with the cigarette smoking man. But they actually appear in multiple shows. You know, there's all these theories about interconnected universes and stuff, TV universes, and Morley's a big part of that. You know, Spike and Buffy, he smokes Morley's. He's great, you've got all these characters interlinked with it. So I really like the kind of, Morley's have been kind of been this presence in the X-Files since day one, really, with the cigarette smoking man. So almost to kind of shine a bit of light on them as a company is a really, I kind of really appreciate that. And it's almost like a mythology within the show itself in a way, having Morley's there. So I really like that angle of it as well. And particularly in terms of that scene when Skinner and Mulder are in the briefing room with all the lawyers, I liked Mulder flipping back, "I can't answer, that will break FBI confidentiality." I like Mulder saying, "I can't answer that, that will break the FBI confidentiality, the sensitive nature of the investigation," and kind of throwing it back in their faces. It was a really, really a kind of fun Mulder moment as well.
Yeah, I like what you were saying there, Baz, about the kind of metatextuality of Morley's as a tobacco company. And what I also like about this, bringing in Morley's, is you're getting this theme of evil corporation, and tobacco is very much seen by a lot of people across the world as an evil entity. And I like the way that tangentially then kind of links to a cigarette smoking man. So you've got this kind of foreboding moodiness to this episode because of the history of Morley's, I think. And I really like the way that happens. Again, the boardroom, the way it's visually designed, it's all browns and yellows. There's lots of different textures. It gives this tobacco look. How the fingers that Weaver has, the tobacco stained fingers, that colour is the colour of this boardroom. And I really like the way they incorporated that. And it does give, I mean, even though I only rated this episode a 5 out of 10, I do think this episode has a great mood and a great atmosphere. The final scene for me, I do not like at all. I'm sure we'll get to that. Yeah. But I do think that this theme of evil corporation, tobacco company, big corp, it's very much this overbearing, almost invincible power that they believe they are. And, they keep going, "That will break confidentiality, that will break confidentiality." They can't get anything out of them.
No, it's really interesting because it almost plays on the same scale as when they're dealing with things like the syndicate. You know, this is big, powerful corporation there. And yeah, it's always interesting that the cigarette smoking man is in the episode. You almost feel his presence because he's been so connected to Morley's over the years. You almost expect the cigarette smoking man to be in the boardroom. Why, you know, surely he is on the board. He has shares in Morley's. He has to because he's like the biggest customer there is. So it's almost like the presence of the cigarette smoking man hangs over this episode, even though he's nowhere to be seen. And and I think you're saying about the yellows and the browns and the smoke as well. You kind of was. I mean, I'm not a smoker. But you almost feel like, you know, when you go into a room with people who smoke and you kind of get that smell and you almost can feel it. You can almost feel it watching the episode. So that's kind of where the episode almost goes back to the old school feel of the X-Files of the early years, because it's almost got that atmosphere to it and that kind of sense of unclean dirtiness about it. When you're watching, you can feel smoke, you can feel the tobacco even through the screen.
Yeah, I almost feel I need to take a shower and wash my clothes after watching this episode, because it just has that really dingy dirtiness to it.
When it says the cure for cancer, and I instantly think of Enemy. That's the first thing I think of whenever I've seen this episode. It's like, there's that kind of aspect to it as well. I mean, now we're talking about that in that regard. So, you know, towards the back end of the episode, we get almost like callbacks to the likes of Paperclip. As well, where, you know, we've got the all the genetics that's happening in there, and Skinner's playing the role of Mulder in some ways when he's talking, but it's more of the corporate stuff. I mean, I actually think, to a degree, I know it kind of the towards the back end of the episode it kind of falls down a little bit, but I think that's one of the more powerful moments, that Skinner's getting the chance. He says "son of a bitch" at one point, which very kind of mythology kind of aspect to it.
And a Sazi, yeah.
Yeah, so we get those kind of callbacks. I mean, it would be interesting to see X-Files in that way. I mean, Blacklist does that in ways as well. I know I was calling out Blacklist before, but Blacklist has overarching, you know, myth arc kind of stories, which are more corporate, or, you know, it's the underworld of the criminal underground, that kind of thing. And X-Files has its own mythology. We've got the evil stuff coming in season 8 and season 9. But the corporate stuff is really interesting. And I'll throw it back to like Fringe. It's the perfect example of like moving on from that, isn't it? That they kind of take that, and the massive dynamic stuff really kicks in as well, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, you didn't really get big corporations in the X-Files. It was always like as someone working in a corporation was evil or a monster or people in his big companies being attacked. You never really had the corporation themselves being the bad guys. And I think that's what's quite almost fresh about this in a way for the time. I think it was a little bit different from other X-Files villains.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, calling back to Fringe, that's an interesting way, because the corporation of Massive Dynamic is so integral to the entire mythos and story of Fringe. And the weird thing about Massive Dynamic is it's not really an evil corporation, but it kind of stands in this kind of moral vacuum, because it's just about advancement of science regardless of what happens to other people and regardless of the consequences of their experiments. So that sits in that pocket, whereas this is firmly sitting the tobacco industry in the evil corp box, and very much playing towards that.
So going back to the scene where the lawyering up, and you've got this to and fro of saying we cannot restate this because of confidentiality reasons. You know, Massive Dynamic, as you know, as an example in season 1, was a bit more like that. It was kind of like, you know, give Olivia a little bit and then not give her enough, kind of thing. But the way that Mulder plays this, I mean, I know that some people say it looks tight, but I actually quite like the way he sarcastically says, you know, I'm sorry, I can't. Answering that question would violate FBI confidentiality due to the sensitive nature of our investigation. Just that throwback. Peter Voss, straight after that, then gets kind of Weaver kind of moves to him because Scobie was his go-to. So let's talk about Weaver for a bit, because you mentioned he's probably the strongest character in this, and the way that he's played. He obviously uses or tries to use the American term, doesn't he? I mean, we're all British, so but e pluribus unum, And he keeps going. He keeps going, e pluribus ea. And he doesn't quite get there. The way that he's portrayed is very similar to the way that we have it in Feith. You know, it's that kind of the intelligence of the man, and he's a result of something that's happened. Now, I know it's more of a revenge story, Feith, but it's a similar kind of feel to it. But the difference here is that he's found himself kind of like a Vince Gilligan kind of story, isn't it? It's a little man who finds himself really big, and he uses this to his advantage. So by going to Voss, he's then making a power move there, which is, you know, you can imagine in Scobie, he might have just been, oh, well, I've ended up in this position, but this is where he kind of takes that next step, Baz, doesn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he has all the power in the episode. I mean, as much as Voss is trying to control the situation and lawyering up and trying to handle what's really going on, Weaver is the wild card here. Weaver is the one that can kill, who basically has all the secrets. You know, as powerful as this company is, Weaver can expose them completely. So he has all the power. And it helps that, you know, Tobin Bell has such a great presence in this episode. I think he really makes the episode. I think he makes it better, because there's a real sense of threat from him every time he appears on screen. Like when he almost steps out the shadows when he confronts Voss, and you know, he has this power. And Voss up to this point has been very kind of arrogant and confident in what he's doing, and then Weaver undermines that a bit as well. So you do start to see this kind of wild card character in Weaver, and I think it makes the episode more interesting.
Weaver in some ways reminds me of Wilson Pinkner Rawls in Trevor, in the way that he holds this power, and in this case it's power of information. He has information that he can hold over this corporation and expose them if he doesn't get what he wants. Whereas Wilson Pinkner Rawls gained this supernatural power, and with that power he then felt this invincibility, this arrogance that he could walk into any room and walk out of it. And I think Weaver has the same kind of invincibility with this information that he's got. And for the most part, he can literally dictate everything and what's going on. He can get his addiction fixed, his cigarettes. And then when he starts, you know, when Voss offers him money to get out of town, he just goes, you know, that's a start. So he's an intelligent, very quick-minded bloke. Even though he kind of ponders around as though he's a slow kind of lunking man, his mind's always ticking away really, really quick.
Yeah, and
he's
streetwise, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I really like that about his character. And it only falls down at the end, really, when he thinks he can walk out of the room without Skinner shooting him. And of course, Skinner does in the end. I'm not sure how I feel about that scene altogether, but we can get to that when we get to it. But for the most part, I think Weaver's character is the glue that holds this episode together.
Yeah, yeah, and you're right with the, as you say, the power thing, because, you know, we can talk about that now in a bit if we like. It's the way that, as you say, he feels almost invincible, and you know that's a Walter White story. If you ever hear one, isn't it? It's a Vince, as I mentioned, a Vince Gilligan kind of story of this man finds himself in a position of power. He can get the money, he can get the power, he can have the things that he needs. He feels that no one will actually do anything to him because he is the epitome, all of life's work. If you want to go down the mythology work route of, like, he is the alien human hybrid in the corporate world, isn't he? So, and then, you know, it takes someone like Skinner to actually go, actually, no. But it is interesting that it is that kind of that character beat of, you know, I become more and more confident as more and more things happen. And Baz, I mean, what do you think to that arc for Weaver over the course of the episode?
It goes a certain way. I think it's, they do enough to establish him and the power play between him and Voss, and they make him a formidable threat. But I think it's probably where the episode doesn't go far enough. You know, there's not much more to him than being very kind of gravelly and almost like soft-spoken and being threatening. You know, Tobin Bell does bring a huge amount to the episode. You know, his presence is good. I think in a lesser actor, I think this episode would be a lot worse. I think if it was a mediocre actor playing Weaver, I don't think we would be. I know we're still saying it's middling, but I think we'll be thinking less of the episode possibly with a poor actor in that role, even as a boring actor in the role. So I think he certainly just brings enough to it. But I think, I don't know, the episode seems to change. It doesn't quite know where it wants to be, because you go from this grisly murder and then Mulder being going straight into the, oh, it's an evil bug, and the kind of corporations. And then you bring in Weather into the mix as well. It becomes quite interesting, quite nuance in terms of all the different kind of power plays going on, and then it becomes a grisly murder after grisly murder and Mulder dying, and it doesn't, and it kind of falls off then. And I don't think Weaver, he's very confident. I think maybe because we're coming to the end of his story, you know, he's not someone who basically almost becomes infected at the beginning and then grows in power and confident. He's kind of at that place when the episode starts, so he doesn't really have anywhere to go, which is why I think his confidence is always at such a height that he doesn't believe Skinner will shoot him at the end, and he gets killed. But it's I don't think it's much. There's not that much of a story to Weaver, because we're at the end of the story already.
Yeah, so that's interesting actually. If this was retold a little bit, that you actually got to see him in the trials, or what happened and how he became that powerful. I mean, we're only talking a 45-minute episode. It is possible. It's possible to do it. There's a great episode in that, for what you're saying, I think, with having that. But you're right with, I think, you know, thinking about it in that way, that we're at the season five of Breaking Bad, not at season one. So it's a bit like, oh, right, okay, well, you know, but it's an interesting concept, nevertheless. And as you say, I think a lesser actor would have like not really done it justice, and I get it. And I think where it falls apart for me is the fact that we have to write Mulder out because of the Hollywood AD thing, because mm-hmm. you've got to write that out. I think him reacting in the way that he does in certain moments with Mulder, if we move on to him, where he actually starts to like breathe and stuff like that, is quite at the very minute time, quite effective. But it's like, it's, you know what, and again, if we talk about the ending, it quickly switches around. It quickly switches off, which we'll talk about shortly. But I mean, Luke, what do you think to the way that Maud's portrayed here? Because there's a moment at the beginning where he says about the bug, and Skinner goes, "What, I have to tell that to the director?" It's like, well, yeah, that could have been more. I feel that could have been helped a bit more. There is that lackadaisical Mulder kind of just going through the motions a little bit. Although I don't think it's his worst performance in the season. I still think it's a good performance from him. But there is a kind of just delivering what he needs to, and does it succinctly, I think. But what do you think to Mulder in this?
Yeah, Duchovny.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
He didn't seem 100% engaged, but as you said, he is more disengaged in other episodes of season 7. I do feel that the writers have struggled writing around Duchovny and Anderson, trying to get them out of the picture for a bit, because they both need to finish off their respective episodes. This episode literally is in between those episodes, so I think it slightly suffers for it in a way. Luckily, this is a season with Fight Club and First Person Shooter in it, so Brand X doesn't get at the bottom of the heap, thankfully. But yeah, you know, there's some great Mulder quips in this episode where I did actually like Duchovny's performance. My favourite being, "You can't blow a whistle with a mouth like that," at the beginning. I love that. I thought it was brilliant. it's a great thing. But yeah, him, you know, putting him in hospital is purely a logistical move to allow him, you know, not to be in the episode. There is some tension in those scenes. There's a little bit, as you say, but you know, we all know that he's gonna pull through. It is quite refreshing actually to have Mulder on the hospital bed and not Scully. That's kind of nice. And then that kind of leads to the doctors basically having to pump him through the nicotine to get rid of the pupae larvae, which then leads to what I think is that ridiculous scene at the end of the episode. But
I mean, it's basically stock Mulder, stock Scully in this episode. Scully does an autopsy, and then Scully's trying to fight to save Mulder's life. Mulder, and they're good. They're good. They both do good performances. And you're right, there are so many episodes, particularly with David Duchovny in season 7, when you can see he's just bored playing Mulder. And I don't necessarily get a sense of that here. I think actually I do enjoy those early scenes of Mulder, you know, Mulder being the investigator, thinking out the box, having those quips. That's all fun. So I do enjoy what we get of Mulder. And Scully's decent as well in that, you know, doing the autopsy and trying to save Mulder's life. But it's stock Mulder and Scully. There's nothing about those characters that you're going to, oh, that's interesting, or that's new. We've seen this all before, you know, several times throughout the X-Files. One of them is dying, and they are literally dying, and the other one is racing to save their life. It happens time and time again. It's almost a cliche in the X-Files.
Yeah.
So to have it here... in one sense, it's quite a clever way of getting about the action and allowing Skinner to take a bit more of the lead, because Scully has a purpose and obviously Mulder doesn't have a purpose because he's infected. But it's nothing new. We've seen this all before.
Yeah. I mean, Skinner will obviously come into play next season, which they don't know that yet, to be fair. But, you know, it's always nice seeing Skinner put in that position. I would agree. I think actually quite like the way that the mundanity of the way that Mulder gets infected. I actually quite like that. It's not like a big masterpiece. It's kind of like just understated. He's just gone round to see Weaver, and I think that works quite effectively. And as I say, I think it works up to a point, and then it's almost like we run out of episode time. It's like, right, well, we've got rid of Mulder. Right, what can we do? Well, he's just going to have maggots like breeding inside him every 20 seconds. And I think it puts a stop clock on stuff, which is, you know, what most TV shows and, you know, movies would do. But the difference being is that this clock seems to just go from 0 to 60 in 5 seconds. And it's like, oh, right, okay. And that's a big issue for me.
Yeah, in saying that, I do actually really like the scenes. I think there's some really good effective scenes in the middle part of the episode. You know, that the first death you see of the Weaver's neighbor being killed is quite nasty.
Yeah.
And then Mold, obviously, the Thomas Gastel when he's got larvae in their lungs and they've hatched and Mold starts coughing, and it's really, really nasty. You talk about feeling uncomfortable in the shower after it. The thing when they're kind of like hoovering up maggots from inside Mulder's lungs is gruesome stuff. But you know, pure X-Files. It's almost disgusting, but it felt like X-Files to me. You know, in having that kind of Mulder gasping for breath and running up oxygen, and just having those, like having the bug in the oxygen mask as well when it starts to hatch, is actually quite a nasty, quite tense moment. I think obviously Mulder's not going to die. So at this point, I know they both kind of die and come back, you know, in some episodes. It's not one of those episodes, but it's...
He's not going to die. If he does, he'll last 3 months and come back.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's kind of, it's more sense of Mulder isn't going to die, but because he literally got these larvae in his lungs and they're going to hatch and it's going to be a nasty, nasty, violent end. It's more about how does he get out of it? And of course, the episode... Yeah. Fails to actually deliver on that, but to up to a point in this episode when Scully's trying to save him, when they're hoovering out these maggots and there's a bug in the oxygen mask, there's a real sense of how is this going to be resolved, because it is almost like impossible odds. It's like someone dying of this disease and then, you know, they're trying to find the cure at the last minute. It's that kind of stakes at play. So I really like that you really get a sense of how is this going to be resolved. You know, how is it going to get, because it's getting worse and worse. And they don't just have Mulder in a coma. They hoover them out, and all the eggs come back again. There's more larvae and stuff. So it's a constant race in the clock. So I think while the episode does change pace from this early kind of corporate conspiracy episode into a kind of nasty, maggoty deaths and Mulder's life in danger, I think there's some real tension in those kind of middle scenes of the episode.
I do think there's some irregularity to the incubation period of this, because if you look at Scobie at the beginning, he's obviously been at home for quite some time.
And then he starts coughing after a couple of, you know, after a couple of conversations that with Skinner and the wife. So that's taken some time. Then you've got the next door neighbour who's maybe breathed it in over a couple of days, maybe. And then then Mulder's like that. He literally incubation period is like literally an hour.
Yeah.
So in order to rank up the tension of the episode, they have to kind of play around with the fact that the incubation period doesn't really exist in the episode because they have to have this tension rank up towards the end. So that bothered me in a little way.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I can say. And then if we talk about the ending of Oh, It's Nicotine. Oh, look at fingers. Done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
it's very quick. It's very quick.
That's a big issue. Now, I'm going to pull something out here, which sometimes when I'm working on the hosting, I don't always do this, but sometimes I'll pull the transcript off. If I'm in a rush especially, then what I'll do is I'll watch the episode and pull the transcript up and make notes as I go through. And that's what I've had to do today because I had to I hadn't made my notes before we came on. And I use Inside the X generally is the transcript, is the one I tend to use. And sometimes they put little notes in there, which are always quite interesting to read. Some of them are production ones, like I'll look at the way Scully's wig is or whatever it may well be. But this one I found quite funny. It was it was just during the case when they're looking at where if you're asking it basically how it all comes together and Scully says something along the lines of and the only thing I have to go on is medically at this point is Mulder's bug. So it's quite early on in the episode. And she goes, I know an entomologist in UNC Willington, Dr. Libby Nance. I'm not sure if that name's relevant for anyone. It might, I don't know if it was a fan or you know, someone on the production team or something like that. I'm not sure. But Carrie Kay, in the parentheses, actually says, Carrie Kay wonders why they don't find an entomologist at Duke, at NC State, or Chapel Hill less than an hour away rather than going all the way to Willington. Maybe Scully just wants to visit the beach. Or perhaps she wants to make sure there's no possibility of running into Bambi Burabam.
Brilliant.
So I was like, yeah, she could just go and see Bambi. That'd be fine.
Her name is Bambi.
Maybe if Bambi had come back, that would have been a great, that would have elevated the episode a bit and had that kind of tension again.
Yeah, just have Bambi like saying, what do you mean? What do you mean, Mulder's like? So I thought that was fantastic. So if we go briefly back to Voss then, because there's a couple of scenes with Voss where, you know, he is wrangling with this decision that he's made. And you've got Brimley kind of like outside watching him. And he doesn't really know that when Mulder talks to him at the doorstep. But there's moments in that where Voss is like saying, I can't get behind it. I can't do this. I can't, you know, I need to be careful about what I say. Without the lawyers being present, but then he's looking at his family. And Mulder and Voss have a really interesting conversation there, don't they?
I find it interesting because I find Voss, at the beginning, quite unsympathetic as a character, mainly because he's working for a tobacco company, he's working for Big Corp, so I don't feel anything for him at this point. And then when you see him at home, you see the family, you see the house, you see the lovely life he's got, you know that he's trying desperately to protect what he's got because he knows the power that this corporation has over him and has over his silence and has over his family. So it's an interesting scene because you've got that subtext that he is literally protecting his life. He's protecting his family. Even though he wants to talk, I think he has morals, he has a conscience. He wants to, you know, he wants to let the world know what they were actually trying to do, which was trying to make a cigarette that was more healthy or less unhealthy than what they were smoking. So he had good intentions and it went a bit awry. So what I do find interesting is when he does speak up to Skinner later on and the risk that he's taken doing that, because if you go by what we know about what happened to Scobie at the beginning, if you've seen the insider, what happens to Wigand and the harassment and the death threats and what happens to his life, you know, Voss is going to get fired after this. His life insurance is probably going to get taken away from him. He's risked everything, but he has spoken to Skinner. So I find that decision to do that very, very interesting from a character point of view.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say with going back to Anasazi, the way, obviously, you know, you've got you have that conversation between, you know, Mordecai and Klemper. But this is different because Klemper's like just openly telling him the truth. Voss is kind of like accepting the truth and actually just going, actually, I need to confess here. I need to lay out stuff. And again, you talk about that cancer man thing, the cigarette smoking man. You can imagine this almost being, again, kind of like a two fathers, one son kind of conversation. You know, it's that owning up to stuff. But I mean, obviously, cigarette smoking man does it in a different way, but it has that, as I say, that ominous feel that smoking man is in this episode, because it's just, you know, that's where your mind would naturally go. I mean, Baz, what do you think to the way that Voss kind of like sort of over the course of this episode kind of gets to that point where he's kind of accepts and has to say something?
I mean, it does help that Dennis Boutsakaris is a really good actor as well. Again, like Tobin Bell, yeah, really helped elevate the episode. There's a real conviction and belief in him in what he's doing. And he could easily be such a stock bad guy, a stock corporate guy, and you couldn't feel anything for him. But you do get sent to the dilemma as the episode progresses and things are going to get worse and people start dying, that actually, you know, he is coming to that realization of what's going on. I like the interplay with him and Skinner. I'm not sure Skinner said, I'm going to come and protect you and your family after doing such a good job last time with Scorpio. I don't know. Is he really that effective? I don't know. But yeah, you do get a sense, probably more from Voss than really from Weaver, because Weaver's at the end of his journey. Whereas Voss does go for a little bit of a journey. You know, he's trying to cover everything up. You know, things are spiraling out of control and he's trying to keep a lid on everything. And then it's the realization you can't do that and almost becoming the person that he was fighting, which is basically coming to Scorby. So there's a nice element of kind of realization in that journey, helped by Boutsakaris' performance, because you really feel what that conflict within Voss through that performance as well. So I did appreciate that as well. I mean, again, not really enough to really elevate the episode and make it any more than really what it is, but there's some good stuff there, and it's another good kind of central performance, particularly as you are missing the leads for most of the episode.
Yeah, I think the ideas are all there. I just think that it's not necessarily has the enough, as I say, maybe tension. It just seems to be like we're going through the motions rather than actually, you know, having those bits. I mean, yeah, you could say about the element with Weaver at the end where he's like saying, come shoot me. There's a little bit there, but when Voss is owning up, I think it's a good, I think he overall plays it really well. As you say, it's more nuanced and I quite like it for that. That's probably one of the reasons why I like it, because it's not showy. But at the same time, you can feel that there's a bit of fatigue season 7 syndrome in that kind of writing. But that pretty much draws the episode to an end. Is there anything that you want to mention at all, Luke, before we head into the mailbag?
I just think if you want to compare this episode with Trevor, in the fact that it's an episode with minimal modern Scully, you've brought in two very good character actors, well-known TV character actors. You had John Dell and Catherine Dent in Trevor. I think Trevor is a stronger episode because of that family drama. I think that's a really well written story, whereas this doesn't have as, it isn't as compelling for me, it isn't as dramatic for me, but it works. And you know, like I said, it teeters on that line between mildly interesting and boring for me. I think whenever Tobin Bell's on screen, it's mildly interesting. When it gets to the kind of Beatles and or, you know, the X-File that they're trying to insert into this corporate espionage, I don't think quite meld with the rest of the story for me.
Okay. I would be on the other half of the swing, so I'd be mildly interesting, quite entertaining. So, Baz, where do you lie?
Yeah, I actually quite like the monster stuff because I'm a big horror fan and I like anything. And I watch a lot of horror movies and, you know, gore, nasty kills, gruesome kills. That's kind of my bag, really. So I quite like it. The CGI is pretty bad, but, you know, I quite like all the nasty deaths and the maggots inside Mulder and stuff. It's kind of, you know, it was a real some tension there. I think maybe because actually the episode storyline isn't strong enough to really engross me. So I kind of latch onto what I like, the horror elements, and I go with that, really. But it's I think it's just a shame that it all kind of falls apart at the end as well, because you've got two good actors. I mean, the leads are, they're not as going for them. They're not as bored, not as going for the emotions they have been in other season seven episodes, certainly. And obviously, Mitch Pileggi holds it together with Skinner as well. You got some good. You got two leads. Generally, the cast is a good, solid cast, and it yeah. kind of they help they elevate the episode a little bit. But I think it's just a shame that it all falls apart at the end with the idea, oh, smoking doesn't kill. We can actually save their lives and nicotine addiction saves Mulder. It's like, oh, really? It just kind of, it almost feels like, oh, and Mulder's now addicted to cigarettes and we all have a laugh and that's how the episode ends. And it's like, with the sinister music, it's like, oh.
I hate that scene so much.
Yeah.
It's just stupid.
It's like this bizarre chemotherapy thing where he basically pumped full of nicotine and then he's like, oh, now Mulder smokes Morley's. It's like, oh, it's like if we're gonna, he's become more like a cigarette smoking man, there are better ways of doing it than this. I don't know.
Yeah, but there's that whole, I think, what they were trying to relive X-Files of old, weren't they, where Mulder's looking and you never see him smoke again, but does he sometimes smoke, you know, that kind of thing, you know, where you'd see, you know, the end of Die Hard Duvalets, for example. You know, you get that kind of moment in early X-Files where you're left with a pondering a question. But it's not a great one. And it almost is it playing it for laughs? Is it playing it for, like, it feels like it's playing it a little bit for laugh, but it's like, I don't know. I don't know where it lies. And
see, I think the episode's been too serious in its approach to have something that could be played for laughs at the end. That's the trouble. If they made a comedy, maybe, you know, on the vein of, I forget the name of the episode, with Bambi in for season three.
And the Copperfields.
That's the one, yeah. You know, you kind of, you know, obviously that, not Darren Morgan, though, because, you know, people can write as good as Darren Morgan, but, you know, had a bit more comedy. But then saying that season seven is so kind of lighter in a way. Season six was lighter, but I think I enjoyed season six. Season six is much more enjoyable. Season seven is tired. So I did actually appreciate that they went back a little bit towards that kind of darker old school horror and atmosphere they were trying to recreate, but they didn't go far enough with that and then kind of had this almost jokey ending. It's completely at odds with the rest of the episode thematically as well.
This has been an interesting discussion because all of three of us are coming from it slightly different ways. That I'm looking at it from more from the conspiracy aspect and it doesn't really do enough there. So it's like it's got all the tools and all of the right people. It just doesn't seem to coalesce into a solid foundation for it to, like, really kind of push it. And don't get me wrong, I love body horror stuff. I always love it when people, even now, I sometimes think this, when people say, like, you know, The Thing's one of the best horror movies ever. It is one of the best movies ever. I just don't think of it as horror. It's probably the closest thing I think to as horror. I think more of it as a sci-fi, you know, film. Because I don't recognize in my head, I don't really recognize horror. But when people say, oh, that's horror, what is it? You know, it's not in my complex to think about it in that way, but it has got the darkness to this, and you know, that's something to behold. So let's move into the mailbag then, and we'll see what other people have been saying, and we should go and do that now. Okay, so Chris Knowles, I really like this one for sentimental reasons. Tobin Bell supernaturally embodies every drunk townie I ever met growing up. We both grew up right off the Weymouth Landing, just a few blocks and a few decades apart. That's funny. That's a lovely personal approach, that, from Chris. Fantastic. Ronald Wilson, it's one of those better than many people give it credit for episodes. It's not in my top 100, but I like it, especially this guest character and this catchy tagline. They should have put that in the title. They should have put that in the title sequence. Missed opportunity. Once again, we have a rare Skinner-centered episode, but it doesn't just get the kudos that good Mulder and Scully episodes get. So Ronald's basically saying it's better than most people give it credit for. Do you think it is one a bit like what Luke and I have discussed in Trevor? I personally feel that. I do feel that after reappraising this one and looking at Trevor from last season, this is where Carl thought to me that I was going to go with Feith, and I've actually found it more in Brand X. So I'll give you, Baz, the floor there first. Do you think it's a, you know, one that people should give a bit more credit to or not?
I think there's some good ideas here, some good moments of horror, some good ideas, good guest performances. So I would say, yeah, I think in terms of In terms of season seven, absolutely. I think it's one of the probably the slightly stronger episodes in a way. I mean, I'm trying to not commit too much, but I find season seven quite tired, you know. And I think there's only two or three episodes in season seven which I'd rate in kind of my favourites anyway. But it surprised me. I haven't watched this episode for years and years and years. Even when I did a rewatch, I did a lot of X-Files before the new series came out. I did like two thirds of a season. I kind of went through, skipped the more rubbish ones or forgettable ones, and I did skip this one that time round. So it's been a long time since I've watched it, and I was, despite saying 6 out of 10, I was quite pleasantly surprised.
It's tonally muddled for me, this episode. I think I would, if, you know, in the context of season seven, I would say this is one of the average episodes, or average, you know, I would say average to just above average, even though I've only given it a 5, because I think there are episodes in season seven that are much worse than this. Because I think Ronald mentioned a good Skinner-centric episode. I don't think it does enough to be a Skinner-centric episode, in my personal opinion. Yeah. I mean, he's in a good amount of scenes. He's got the responsibility of this case because the director put him on the witness protection. But apart from that last scene with Tobin, I just don't think it's as good a centric episode as others have been in the past.
It feels like a proto 8 or 9 episode Skinner. You know, yeah. It feels like it's either Skinner with Doggett or Skinner with Doggett Reyes or Skinner with Scully and Doggett. You know, it feels like that proto version of that, really.
They're almost preparing him for season 8 and 9 without knowing that they're preparing him for season 8 and 9.
Yeah, definitely. It doesn't feel like a Skinner-centric episode, though, in terms of the earlier ones they've done.
Tony Black has been on as well. He says, I mean, it's basically Michael Mann's The Insider, isn't it? Put through the X-Files plot machine, but I've always liked this one. Tobin Bell utterly drips shabby, genuine, nasty, off-kilter menace. This is a pre-Jigsaw, and you know you can totally see the through line. While his performance and Mark Snow's superb, ominous score are probably the best thing about this, I nonetheless always find this quite a ride. Love how they find a way to incorporate the long-term Morley brand into the story, though. If ever an episode probably should have featured the Smoking Man. So that's a question. And we say that Smoking Man feels like he's in this episode. Do you think it would have been worth it, or do you think it was just another, would have been a throw-in, really, and it's better for him to be in our thoughts rather than actually being on screen?
I don't know, because we could always imagine him in that me room with the lawyers at the beginning. You always imagine him in the corner smoking a cigarette, just being there. And think, oh, he's there. Of course he's there, you know, I think. But I think it would have to be reframed in a slightly different way, probably linked almost to conspiracy in a way that some others, like Enemy, for example, were, you know, because I think it would have to be done slightly differently. Otherwise, it is play for laughs. And apart from that final scene, the episode doesn't really go for laughs. So I would say probably not.
Had it been in an earlier season, I think you could have had more of a thing for it. I think if you had played it's like sort of, you know, like your Eve experiment and stuff like that, it would need to be quite significantly into the show because you'd need to understand Cigarette Smoking Man being in there. But for me, I think it would need to be, you know, like a season 4-ish episode if that was the case.
And I think you'd also need it to be filmed at a time when David Duchovny has more time to be in the episode, because I think if you were going to bring CSM into this particular story, you would need those interactions and you'd need Duchovny and Mulder in there a bit more to tackle with the scenes with CSM as well. And I think with, you know, Duchovny only being in this for between 10 and 15 minutes in total, it wouldn't have worked.
Okay. Carl Sweeney. Always felt this one was a bit of a drag. That's it.
True.
That's all we need. That's all we need from
That's
Sweeney.
All we need from Mr. Sweeney. Nicole Wilson-Ripson, one of my favourites. I love the concept. I love the cinematography. I love how much Skinner we get. I love Mulder in this ep. I still wish they'd tied it into the myth arc, though. I keep waiting for Red Museum-like scene with CSM or Crewcut Man or Krycek or some of his syndicate flunky that never came. I think that relates to what we said before about the corporate kind of mythology, if there was going to be one, really, doesn't it? If it was a season 4 with Skinner, with the Smoking Man, in there, I think that would have worked a little bit better. And as you say, putting Mulder in, like we said. But yeah, it's linking it to the myth arc, I think, would be difficult from that perspective.
Yeah, I do agree with her about the cinematography, though. This episode does look fantastic, and the production design is really good.
Yeah.
Andrew Levitt, I always enjoy Brand X because part of it feels like a classic X-Files episode as Mulder, Scully and Skinner try to get the truth from a corrupt corporation. Daryl Weaver is a character audiences simultaneously love for his deplorable behaviour and emphasise with his unique situation. Indeed, it makes us question whether or not we might do the same thing in his situation. Voss is more sympathetic as an employee of the corrupt corporation, trying to do the right thing by those they've done wrong. While I all enjoy the drama of Mulder and medical malaise because it keeps with the threat of the situation, I think it's underplayed and over far too quickly. Further, Mulder considering smoking at the end is out of character, giving Skinner a more prominent role in the story is always welcome, and Mitch does a great job here. Overall, while it seems to be missing something, it's a distinguished, often overlooked episode and one of the better entries of Season 7. So, do we have an empathy for Weaver? Is there enough there to emphasize have empathy for him? Do you think that's in there, Luke?
For me, I don't think the writers ever intended for us to have any empathy. I certainly don't have any empathy for him at all. I think he is a very devious, very intelligent, very devious man who is out to basically, you know, he's out for himself. And he wants to basically wring this tobacco company for everything they have because he holds the secrets and he holds the information, and information is power. And I do like the way that theme, you know, which is integral to the X-Files, is played into this episode. I do enjoy that a lot. But no, I don't empathise with him at all. And he wears really dirty clothes. I can't empathise with him.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're never most supposed to. I think your sense of that Weaver would have been like this even without this power that he has in the episode. He's someone, you know, he might not have killed, but he's certainly ruthless and devious and intelligent and will always be able to get what he can get, really. And he's just lucked out that he has this power now. So, yeah, I don't think you're ever supposed to feel sorry for him at all.
No, I feel sorry for their situation, right? But I don't feel sorry for the way he reacts to it. I think that's probably the best way of describing it for me.
I think because there were four test subjects, if you had a second test subject who was still alive, you could have played that out and had someone maybe who was dying, but you could feel sorry for them, but not with Weaver.
Kathy Glinsky says, I love seeing Mulder and Skinner work a case together, and the scene where they flash their badges is really fun. Scully's vigilance at the hospital is moving. It's not the strongest episode, but I always enjoy it enough. Then we've got Colin Wattler's Bartley. I like this one, though it will probably never make a list of my true favourites. I think it meets my basic criteria for a scary monster and good Mulder and Scully balance, plus with Skinner too. I think that's the thing with what Cortland's saying there is that, like you've said, Baz, you know, it hits the criteria for scary monster and the kind of the horror kind of stuff. So I think that's a good comment there. Kedwin Foley says, I think this episode is criminally underrated. I really enjoy it. Weaver gets a surprisingly rich characterization for a role that would be easy to write in a tropey way. Tobin Bell brings much casual menace to the part and is wonderfully unsettling. I really liked the novelty of the case coming to them because Skinner is working it himself. After 7 seasons, I imagine it's hard to find a new hook like that. So I always think it's a nice touch. And of course, it's great to see Skinner getting to do some shoe leather detective work. Mulder contracting the parasite is a curveball in a Monster of the Week episode when so often Mulder and Scully are there to observe and remark. It's reminiscent of the high stakes in Scully, for Scully in FM Escalata, and while I don't think it's the pacing or tension here work as well as they did in that episode, I feel like they went for it. Finally, I haven't seen anyone mention Dennis, I think she's put the name in, Dennis Boutsikaris. How do you say that, Luke? You
had Boutsikaris.
Boutsikaris, thank you. Performance as Dr. Voss, but he is another highlight of the episode for me. Squirrel. I can't say squirrel. I've got to like literally go squirrel. Squirrely. His squirrely panic, see, I told you, is a great counterpart both to Weaver and the icy callousness of the Morley executives. And in brackets, now I think about it, he reminds me of the train conductor from 731. Hey, there's that link again. Like the conductor's morally compromised brother. So a lot to delve in there. I think Tobin is very unsettling. I think that works quite well.
Yeah.
I think it's about recognising the guest performances and they help elevate the episode. So yeah, both Voss and Weaver, I think, are what make it a better episode.
Dan Gear says, underrated, yes, criminally underrated, not sure about that. It's definitely a highlight of a largely disappointing seventh season. And that brings it to an end. So thank you both for coming on and putting up with me behind the scenes. There's stuff been going on behind the scenes, which people won't know. But thank you for putting up with me. If people wanted to get more of you two, we mentioned that we've mentioned Doctor Who at the top of the hour. We even mentioned Fringe. So I think, you know, by top loading it with those two, Luke, where can people find you and what you're up to?
You can find me on the We Made This Network at Observing the Pattern, which is the Fringe podcast that I host. We are literally approaching the last three episodes of season three, which is a trilogy finale. It's all one big story, so very exciting there. And Kurt, you're in the middle chapter of that trilogy finale, so it would be good to have you on there. You can also find me on two Starship podcasts, Rarely Going, which I co-host with Craig McKenzie and a cohort of other Star Trek fans, and also Make It So with Kurt North, which is currently on hiatus until season two begins in February, I believe. So that'll be back then.
What a lovely birthday present.
Oh, yes. And you can find me personally on Twitter at Luke_Winch.
Excellent. And Baz, where can people find you?
Yes, on We Made This, I'm on two podcasts at the moment. You mentioned the TARDIS Crew, which is a Doctor Who podcast I host with my 15-year-old son, Ben, who has more knowledge of Doctor Who than anyone else I've ever met. So we have a twice-monthly podcast, and Kurt, you're on our discussion of the Heaven Sent Trilogy, which is coming at the end of October. I'm also one of the main hosts of Authorised Podcast Only, an Alias podcast, which launched in September. You can find me in a few other podcasts on We Made This as well, including Real Talk. I'm hosting a discussion on Halloween Kills in October, so very much looking forward to that. And you can also find me elsewhere on Star Trek The Next Generation podcast, Beyond Firepoint, over at Holosuite Media. And on Twitter, I post everything on there. I'm at Baz Greenland.
Excellent.
You can also, there is a secret project that me and Baz are working on.
Yes.
So if you are a science fiction, a 90s science fiction fan, stay tuned to We Made This.
Coming next year.
I think I know what this is. I won't say anymore.
We get giddy with excitement talking about it. It's going to be good.
Okay. So you can find me on Twitter at R Muldrake. That's R-M-U-L-D-R-A-K-E. We mentioned Make It So, so don't need to worry of that. Coming at the end of October, which is when this is around about due to air, so we're coming to around now, there will be a 25th anniversary special of The Time Is Now, which is talking about Millennium. We have behind the scenes, I've been doing some recordings, and we've done the commentary on The Curse of Frank Black for Millennium, which is obviously a 1013 production. And I've done the pilot commentary. I've done a conversation with A New Perspective with Christopher Pilbeam, for those people who have heard Christopher on this podcast before. And there's also going to be our very special event happening down in Birmingham, which is a special event where Glenn Morgan is going to join us live on a call. And we're going to be talking about The Curse of Frank Black and the episode Home. So that is something to look forward to. So that should be happening in a couple of weeks after you hear this, maybe even a week after you hear this, if you're hearing it when it gets released. So I'm very looking forward to that. Not only that, I'm going to meet a good friend of mine, someone called Mr. Winch. I don't know if I believe he's coming. So
front row to heckle.
He's going to heckle. He's going to heckle like there's no tomorrow. And I'm going to see what I can come back with. But that's where you can find me. So I'm looking forward to that. That's with Carl Sweeney and Tony Black. We're going to be going down to Birmingham. All fingers crossed, everything goes well, and that happens. So see us there, and we'll have some specials on that as well. So as I say, the Millennium podcast you can find at The Time Is Now pod. But X-Files and Millennium and Fringe and Doctor Who aren't what we're talking about. We are actually talking about other things on the network, and you'll hear some of them at the end of this podcast. So listen out to some of the clips there. But thank you again, guys, for coming on. I'll be hopefully glad to see you in future seasons. So thank you for coming on. Baz, welcome to the official channel.
So been a pleasure to be here. We enjoyed it.
Good stuff. And we'll see you next time. But until then, remember, trust no one.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
Observing the Pattern, a fringe podcast.
Maybe people weren't quite ready for it. Maybe they wanted a bit more of what The X-Files was, which was a much more of a kind of monster of the week, scare you, or this kind of myth arc, which had its emotion and certainly had its strong themes of family as well. But I think Fringe had it much more to the fore, much more kind of focused through line for it.
And, you know, Luke, that's a really good observation in terms of, you know, like why it didn't catch on as much, because I do remember these conversations when it was airing live. And I want to say it was season 3, 4, and 5 where the fans really like took to Twitter and was like, and were like, you know, please renew this show.
Chucky Vision.
I think it's the most graphic of the lot of them.
I think it's the context that was just surreal. I mean, but yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how I would react as a censor to this, because, you know, we see, like, as we keep saying, we see Chucky jack off, but we don't just see, like, his reactions. There is literally a close-up shot of him grabbing his dick.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a fucking turkey baster dripping with jizz.
Oh my
How
god.
The actual fuck? Is this a 15?
Well, I think if you make something cartoonish enough, then you will get away with it.
and it does feel like they got away with it.
Rarely Going, an animated Star Trek podcast.
To me, the one thing that keeps coming up in these episodes is Boimler is actually a really good leader.
Mm.
And he's got, yeah, like he actually earned his place on the Titan. Like, you know, it was kind of made of a joke. His transporter clone ended up getting to stay on the Titan, and he got sent back to the Cerritos and even got demoted when he did that. But, you know, time and again in each episode this season, Boimler has proven that he has what it takes to be a good leader. He has what it takes to be a command officer. I think that...
Absolutely.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at the X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the X-Cast pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.